ashes for a third glorious decade of total law enforcement.
How long have you known the plaintiff?
I haven't actually seen it, but I have seen the firm, and I'm planning on renting the Pelican Booth.
I must declare a mistrial, which is a term I've heard people use in the movies. Tap, tap, tap. Case ended.
I got the shotgun. Got the briefcase. It's on the game, though, right?
Judge gave me two ankle bracelets. Said it was the first time he ever had to do that. Your boy's a question on the bar exam. You heard?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 541. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew Torres, Esquire. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Thomas Smith, Esquire. How are you doing?
Doing great now that I'm officially a lawyer is what that means. Don't say anything in response. It definitely means I'm a lawyer. Okay, let's get on. So today we have a fantastic guest, Monica Miller, back on the show. She's always great. Can't wait to talk to her about Happy the Elephant. Related to, I don't know if the elephant's on heroin or what, related to the cocaine hippo case, we'll see. But a lot of interesting stuff there. We've got too much to talk about, so we'd better get to it. Before that interview, we've got all kinds of Andrews and Thomases. We're both right and wrong in every combination and permutation of that. So let's head on to that.
Wrong. Everybody cries.
All right, so regarding hippos being the most dangerous animal, what did the internet have to say about that? I saw a number of conflicting messages.
As you might imagine, the internet had some opinions on that. So a bunch of people, including Dee Dashevsky on Patreon, decided to, you know, sort of quibble and talk about how about the mosquito, for example, right?
Mosquitoes are insects. It's a different, I know it technically could be in part of the animal kingdom or some crap, but like, come on.
The underlying factor is hippos are the deadliest animal in Africa. And we got a great response from our buddy Ben Young, who writes, I'm sure you're gonna get a lot of responses to this, but as an amateur naturalist and the host of the wildlife show Wild New York on YouTube, Subtle plug, I figured I should add at least one more. The hippopotamus is not the deadliest animal in the world. You're likely thinking of the adage about it being the deadliest animal in Africa, but in terms of pure head count, that is not technically correct. The best kind of correct. That honorific belongs to the mosquito, kills an estimated million people a year on the continent.
Mosquito. I do not acknowledge that. Sorry.
If you exclude humans who kill
I was going to make that joke. Yeah. Humans are actually the most dangerous game.
Yeah. 100,000 other humans annually. The hippo's a strong number two, and at an estimated 3,000 deaths per year, the hippo kills more people than the big five, cape, buffalo, elephant, rhino, leopard, and lion, plus Nile crocodiles combined. Highly territorial and difficult to kill, their skin is 2 inches thick and bulletproof to most small arms fire. Hippos average between 3,000 and 4,000 pounds, can run 30 miles per hour on land and 5 miles per hour in the water.
Killing machines.
Running 5 miles. Have you ever tried to run in the water?
Oh, I know. Zero miles an hour.
Yeah, that's zero. That's the human's upper limit. Zero. Unlike many of the other animals who will exhibit bluff charges and flee, if a hippo decides you're a threat, you're basically clown horned.
No wonder Pablo Escobar coked him up. That is a killing machine.
And then he adds, we'll give you the plug here. For more fun wildlife facts and to learn about some of the more than 600 species of wildlife that call New York City home, check out our YouTube channel, youtube.com/c/wildnewyork, or visit our social media pages at Wild New York Show. There you go.
Here's the thing. That all said, I was right. So I don't know what you have this title, Thomas Was Wrong. If the whole reason I was wrong is that an insect is the deadliest animal, then I don't give a shit about that. That's not, when you think about like, what's the deadliest animal? No, people don't, I'm not factoring it. Do we factor in coronavirus? Like what's an animal? I mean, come on. Is that the only thing that's higher is mosquitoes?
Well, we got a neat clarification from Andrew Payne. I don't know if this is you being wrong, but I like this. He says, years ago, my wife and I were in Botswana, and the locals told us that the hippos were considered the most dangerous local animal, but not because they directly killed people by stomping or biting them, but rather that they would frequently capsize fishermen's boats when they got too close, and thus indirectly kill them via drowning. Apparently, wow. Hippos view the fisherman plus boat as a single entity, much like how we were safe around lions, even in an open top Jeep, since they couldn't mentally distinguish us from the vehicles that we were in. So for the hippo, the boat is the invading entity and what gets attacked, not the person. Unfortunately, few people in Botswana know how to swim, even despite being employed as a fisherman. And as such, drowning by hippo was not uncommon. I've been able to confirm this online. Sorry, he says, I've not been able to confirm this online. Most articles just mention the number of people killed by hippos, but not the method they're in.
Yeah.
Just thought it was interesting. I agree. Very, very interesting.
All joking aside, it is interesting to try to figure out methodology here, you know, because if it's like number of humans killed per year would be one metric. But on the other hand, if it's a very dangerous animal that we don't interact with much, it's interesting because, okay, so I decided to finally just Google it because, you know, I think it's more fun to get 800,000 emails. It's actually more fun. But, you know, I Googled it and the, you know, Wikipedia, I'm just barest level of research here. List mosquitoes, which again, I'm not counting in my mind. I get it. It's technically, I guess, an animal, but that's not the point. But mosquitoes, number one. Snakes, didn't think about snakes. Snakes might be number two. I'll count a snake as an animal. That's an animal. And then here's the other thing. Dogs are next, according to this. So, but we all interact with 900 dogs per minute. Like I'm wondering, in terms of time of interaction or number of interactions kind of thing, because it's a genuine question of like, okay, which kills, certainly killing most humans per year is a fine, you know, I get it. That's a straightforward metric that is totally acceptable. But on the other hand, if you were to phrase it of like, which is the deadliest animal on earth? So what is the animal that if you were, you know, you had to be locked in a cage with them, what would you least like to be locked in a cage with? Like, what would you be most scared of if you came across them? And obviously, dog, I don't think would be higher than hippopotamus. Like, there's a chance. You have a chance against a dog. I mean, you could be a really nice doggy. Maybe it's just Andrew's doggy over there, and you just get to have a nice time with a nice doggy. You know,
I am now picturing a hippo sized corgi and I just can't stop laughing. That's the way it goes.
Crocodiles, scorpion. I'm not counting insects. Can somebody give me a list that doesn't include insects? So anyway, all right. I think I'm officially wrong, but not because of mosquitoes. I'm wrong because of snakes. I'll accept it. But I do think that if there is some actual measure of per interaction, it would be interesting to see what that was, because I think we can all acknowledge that dogs are not like quote unquote more deadly than hippos on a one-to-one basis. But because everybody owns a dog and there's a zillion of them, yes, obviously they're going to be more people killed by dogs. But anyway, we've got lots more wrongs and rights. What's next?
This is a more detail, explicitly, and I don't mean this as an Andrew was wrong, is what the letter says. So okay. I'm going to read it. It's from David Jensen, who says, in episode 538, while discussing Judge Schroeder's background, Andrew described the case of Mark Jensen. Mark Jensen is my father, and I wanted to clarify slash expand upon the coverage in the show. Andrew is correct that during Dad's first trial, concluded in 2008, the Wisconsin Supreme Court did rule to affirm Schroeder's allowing the letter to be presented at trial, relying on the 2004 Supreme Court case of Crawford versus Washington and applying the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine. However, since his conviction, the case has been continued to be appealed. Briefly, in 2013, the U.S. District Court of Eastern Wisconsin overturned Jensen's conviction, relying on a 2008 Supreme Court case, Giles versus California, to conclude that the letter should not have been allowed at trial. That was affirmed by the Seventh Circuit in 2015, remanded back down to Kenosha for release or retrial in 2017. Judge Kirkman in Kenosha stated that due to recent precedent created in other cases, the letter could be admitted under a different standard. But since the evidence presented would not be significantly different than in the first trial, ruled to reinstate the conviction without a trial. And then in 2020, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals District 2 rules via summary disposition to overturn the conviction, affirms that Jensen must be released or retried without the letter. That was upheld by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in refusing to take up the case. Currently, the trial is scheduled for May 23rd, 2022. However, Wisconsin did file for cert with the Supreme Court. My dad's attorneys have to respond by early November. I just wanted to clarify that the admittance of my mother's letter and statements has since been overturned. This case has obviously been a big part of my life. And while I generally make it a point to avoid speaking publicly about it, I felt compelled to write in as I admire OA's commitment to accuracy, honesty, and transparency. Well, thank you so much. I'm kind of blown away. We wrote back to David and asked for his permission to read this on the air.
That never ceases to amaze me. The people we hear from, it's so interesting. For the non-lawyers, can you demystify that a little bit? There was a lot of citations and references of what's happening there. Dumb it down for me.
So Schroeder is saying, hey, I ruled to let the letter in. That got overturned at the intermediate appellate level, but
again, this was the letter saying, like, if I die,
if anything happens to me, my husband did it.
Okay.
Right? Check out my husband is who you should look at first, is what I think the letter says.
Which, again, we acknowledge, and I was saying, like, that is interesting, because if you know, like, who knows the circumstances around when that letter was written? Maybe it's, you know, one argument that actually wasn't significant, or it could be very, very, very significant. It's hard to know.
And that's why this is a hard case. This is one of the sort of quintessential, you know, definitions of, you know, hard cases in the HLA hard sense. So Schroeder was correct that was reinstated at the Wisconsin Supreme Court level. But then in post-conviction relief, the case upon which the Wisconsin Supreme Court relied in 2008 has since been superseded by another case from the Supreme Court. And so the federal courts have said, nope, the letter is back out. They remanded back down to have a trial. There is currently pending a petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court. So one of two things is going to happen. Either the Supreme Court will grant cert in the Jensen case and kind of take up the question squarely, right, of, hey, implicating letter, is that in or out, and rule sort of with finality. Or they'll deny cert and trial will go forward in May of 2022.
That's so interesting. And again, so then you got to do another trial. And who knows how much the letter mattered, right? I mean, is that part of the legal process to say, look, this doesn't matter at all? Or is it just an important legal question that you have to settle one way or the other, regardless of if the letter would have made a difference?
Yeah, well, that's right. That's what the trial court tried to do, right? Because it recognized the reality of, it's 20 years later. Like,
yeah, how do you do
reconstructing
another trial?
The basic witnesses is going to be impossible. Yeah. And so that court did an analysis and said, yeah, well, you know, we've got this instruction. My view as a judge is that the evidence that would have come in would not have been materially different. So I'm going to reinstate the conviction without having a new trial. And that's what the appellate court overturned and said, no, yes, you are.
All right. Well, thanks for writing in, as always. Like, it's so cool to hear from everybody. I mean, there's so many interesting people listen to the show and get back to us. It never ceases to amaze me. I know I jokingly interact with some of you about being wrong or right. That's all jokes. I love hearing from each and every one of you. We really do.
Absolutely.
One more wrong?
No, maybe two more. Two things I was definitely wrong about. So Brendan Robinson and a bunch of listeners wrote in to say when I was discussing trademark law and how it generally favors the large companies, i.e. McDonald's, because they're everywhere. They wrote in to say, and I'm just going to read Brendan's, sometimes it does bite the big guys and the smaller business wins the day. Here in Australia, Burger King is not known as Burger King. The name on the door, all the advertising, etc., is Hungry Jack's.
Mm.
All the Burger King items, like the Whopper.
That's a better name.
Yeah, it is. Are sold under the Hungry Jack's label. Basically, in 1971, when the franchise came, they couldn't use the name because there was a small chain of takeaway restaurants in the state of South Australia that already used the name. They thus branded themselves Hungry Jack's. The Australian franchisee, Jack Cowan, opened a bunch of Hungry Jack stores around the country. Around 1996, Burger King, and this is what I love about this email. Around 1996, Burger King purchased the rights to the name in Australia, by my understanding, and started opening Burger King stores. Okay. And by the way, like, I mean, that is ultimately when we talk about trademark law, when we talk about copyright, in all of these cases, the ultimate answer is not who's going to court and what's it going to decide. It's who has to write a check to whom, right?
Yeah.
And so if you were the small, if it had worked the other way around, right, and you were the small McDonald's hut, it's not that you would be able to continue to operate a McDonald's in a white with the knockoff, right? It's that McDonald's would then pay you. They'd be like, all right, what do you want to be paid for us to have the right to use McDonald's hamburgers in your area? And you would then be a very, very happy burger owner. So anyway, back to the email, which is almost done. Apparently, Burger King tried to force Hungry Jack's franchises back into their banner. One shopping center food court near me literally had a Burger King and a Hungry Jack's selling exactly the same food within sight of each other. Burger King took Hungry Jack's to court for breach of contract and lost.
Ooh.
So really fascinating stuff. And now I'm hungry.
So what's Burger King in Australia then? Is it Hungry Jack's? Or
it's apparently now both, right?
Like both.
That, huh. Yeah.
I could just imagine me like taking my first trip to Australia. Let's get some authentic Australian food. Ooh, Hungry Jack. Yeah, that sounds
Hungry very, Jack.
Put that another shrimp on the Barbie over here. Get the Australians do food correctly. Am I right? They really know their stuff.
I will say Impossible Whopper tastes exactly like the Whopper. Yep,
just got one yesterday. My fast food, I went from, when I turned vegetarian, zero fast food to then like whoever is the first to incorporate fake meat is going to get me. And so Carl's Jr., Burger King, and actually Taco Bell has great vegetarian options, like sub in the beans. And they're actually the most user-friendly. But anyway, that's all that aside. One more, Andrew was wrong. Let's have it.
Yeah, AMD, American Micro Devices, are still a competitor. I introduced them as a former competitor to Intel. They are apparently still a competitor, still making a variety of chips. In some cases, as some AMD owners wrote in to say, better than Intel. So my apologies for thinking that was a thing in the 90s that went away. Apparently it did not. So I was 100% wrong on that.
I don't remember you saying that because I feel like I would have known that. So I apologize. I will also take responsibility for letting that fly
under my
watch. Yeah. Yeah, no,
not
AMD.
On my watch.
Interesting. This show is brought to you by X Chair. That means you know what time it is. It's when I tell you about my X Chair while sitting in my X Chair. From the moment I sat in this chair, my body immediately said, ah. So this is what a real office chair is supposed to feel like. And I've said it before, I had a chair that was supposed to be very good, was definitely expensive. And guess what? I changed out because it wasn't good enough when I compared it to my X chair. The X chair is way better. This X chair can give you a massage while you're working. It can heat up or cool down, which is critical for me in California. More often it's hot than it is cold. It's all in the LMX massage and temperature regulation, exclusively designed and made for X chair. And once you feel the customized support of X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, your back will never be happy in another chair again. It's high performance, it's quality engineering, it's extreme comfort. Those are all the reasons I love my X-Chair. Take my advice, try X-Chair for yourself risk-free for 30 days. Once you realize how much better your chair should be, you'll never go back, I promise. Go to xchairoa.com now, that's the letter X, chairoa.com, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. That's xchairoa.com. This show is brought to you by Aura. Look, everything is on the internet these days. It's increasingly meaningless to say that. Now it's just like, yes, internet exists, and we all know this, and I'm going to sound like an old person when I say, wow, a lot of things are on the internet. My kids will be like, what do you mean? These are things. You know, they won't know. It's like, now, anyway, everything's on the internet. And it has changed dramatically over the last decade. But some of your security tools may have stayed the same. Aura provides complete digital security to help protect your online accounts, your finances, your devices, and more, all in one easy-to-use app. Most credit card companies do a good job of protecting you against fraudulent purchases, but what if a scammer files for unemployment in your name or if your social media accounts are hacked? Aura's protection goes well beyond your credit card. And just think about how many of your things are online. Photos, finances, devices, banking, everything. And all of those things that are online are things that can be under threat to hackers, to malicious actors. And Aura can sound the alarm if your digital presence is at risk. Aura provides digital security protection to keep your online finances, personal information, and tech safe from online threats. It's all-in-one protection from identity theft, financial fraud, malware, scam sites, and much more. With Aura, you get alerted to fraud and threats fast, like if your online accounts or passwords were leaked online, or if someone tries to open a bank account in your name. Aura is easy to set up. All plans come with $1 million in identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds and experience U.S.-based customer support that's got your back. Aura is a new type of security service that protects all your online information and devices with one simple subscription. With an easy online dashboard and alerts sent straight to your phone, Aura keeps you in control and guides you through solving any issues. For a limited time, Aura is offering our listeners up to 40% off plans when you visit aura.com/opening. Go to aura.com/opening to get complete protection and savings of up to 40%. That's aura.com/opening. And want to welcome back to the show, Monica Miller. Back, gosh, the time has been weird. It could have been either 10 years since we had you or a year. I don't remember which. Any idea?
You know, I'm not even sure myself. It's like, I think we went into a vortex sometime around 2019, and it's like everything is odd.
Monica, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
It's wonderful to be back. Very happy to be on the show.
As everyone knows, this is a hippo-centric podcast a lot of times, but you... You're here to talk about elephants. What's going on with Happy the Elephant?
Well, Happy the Elephant is our client, and she has been imprisoned in the Bronx Zoo for a couple decades. She's a 50-year-old Asian elephant and is living in isolation. And so we filed the first ever writ of habeas corpus in New York on behalf of an elephant, on behalf of Happy. Back in, I want to say, 2018. And now the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in the state of New York, is going to actually hear our case as to whether Happy the Elephant is entitled to the right to bodily liberty, protected by the common law writ of habeas corpus. And basically what we're saying is she a person for the purposes of the common law right to be free?
So we know you from your work with American Humanists, but is this through them or a different organization?
Yeah, so this is through the Non-Human Rights Project, another organization. I've worked for both the American Humanist Association as well as the Non-Human Rights Project since graduating law school. I actually interned for both of them during law school, and I was really fortunate that both of them offered me jobs out of law school, and I couldn't pick one over the other because I actually went to law school to do this personhood type of animal rights based work. And so the church state separation stuff kind of fell into my lap because I felt like how can I possibly move forward with rights for animals and the environment when we've got this conservative Christian force that's stalling and now, you know, overriding rights that we've considered settled for decades. So yeah,
I want to drill down on a couple of the things that you said. So first, just to be clear, the sole right that Non-Human Rights Project is seeking to vindicate here on behalf of Happy is a declaration of personhood in the context of habeas corpus and for the limited right of bodily autonomy, right? The right to be free from imprisonment, right?
Correct. You summarize that better than I think some legal scholars and other folks out there. Yes.
Oh, stop. We are invited on the show anyway. You don't have to flatter me. I mean, that was kind of crucial. You reached out to us after our hippo coverage and said, yeah, that agreed. Everybody's got it wrong with respect to Pablo Escobar's cocaine hippos. But you should know that, you know, there's actually a real case out here. And I think it's why I wanted to lead with that question, because I think the overarching sort of philosophical question and where it kind of gets lost is we think of personhood as conveying a bundle of rights, right? Yeah. And you're not asking for Happy to have the right to sit on a jury or, to vote or something like that.
Right.
I've been sort of describing, when I was describing the case to Thomas, I put it like this. I thought you received about the most favorable trial court ruling against you that it's possible to get, right? Like, is that is that a fair characterization? And if so, like, let's kind of go into it a little bit.
Yeah, I do think it's fair. And I think we've actually had two of those. We had Judge Jaffe's opinion that was before Judge Tuitt's opinion in the elephant case. We actually had a really favorable ruling on our chimpanzee case, in which the court similarly found herself bound by a higher ruling. But yes, you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, I don't see these in my Establishment Clause cases. We see the opposite, which is like, you win, and then like a 10-page concurrence on why we shouldn't win. So yes, very, very wonderful for us to get those rulings.
That the prior case was Coco the chimpanzee, was that right?
The prior case was actually, we've had several prior cases in New York, and each of them, you know, we're using the common law, which is this incremental approach. And so we never kind of thought we were going to fly in and win our first case. We really build up the momentum. And so our first case was actually on behalf of Tommy, the chimpanzee. And Tommy was the first ever plaintiff in one of our civil, you know, our habeas corpus cases seeking personhood. The case that I'm referring to was actually Hercules and Leo, which were chimpanzees owned by the state of New York.
Oh, so I don't know those cases then. So,
What drugs were they on? Heroin or?
Well, you know, our Hercules and Leo case was so compelling because the judge required the state of New York, because they were state-owned chimpanzees. This was not just the first ever writ of habeas corpus issued on behalf of chimpanzees, but it was actually demanding that the state of New York come and justify the detention of the chimpanzees. And Judge Barbara Jaffe issued this ruling from the New York Supreme Court in Manhattan saying, why shouldn't I give these chimpanzees rights? And her opinion looked a lot like Judge Tuitt's, which was, my hands are tied because of this other ruling, but, you know, X, Y, and Z are all the compelling reasons that the Non-Human Rights Project, you know, kind of should win and why we need to give this serious attention.
If you had kind of an elevator pitch on the Happy the Elephant case, I guess elevator pitch to normal person and then elevator pitch to lawyer, right?
Yeah. No, it's hard. The non-lawyer one is really hard for an elevator pitch because we're talking about personhood. I would start by the premise that person and human are not synonymous. Mm-hmm. And as we've discussed, you know, corporations are persons, but other countries have been legalizing or recognizing the personhood of rivers and glaciers and lakes and any entity that's basically capable of having a right that can be enforced in court. So it's somewhat of a legal fiction that we're starting from. And so once you've recognized that anything could theoretically have a legal right, it's not a stretch to say that non-human animals can have a legal right. And what we're asking for, like we've talked about, is not the right to vote or to bear arms, but a right that's appropriate for the species in question. And that's the right to be free from imprisonment, from an unlawful imprisonment, one that is, you know, detaining your ability to exercise your bodily autonomy because you possess bodily autonomy. So, yeah, I don't have a good elevator pitch for the non-lawyer per se, but it would maybe say something to the effect of, it's, you know, all humans have been considered rights bearers at this point in our country, although not historically. As we know, Black slaves were not, they're humans, but they were not considered legal persons. And then when we saw the abolition of slavery, that didn't give every Black person all of the rights under the Constitution. They were given some rights and not others. And so we're just, like you said, seeking the one single right for them to be free from their confinement.
I thought there were a number of interesting things I learned from your brief about elephants, for example,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, first off, this elephant's 50. How long do these things live?
Yeah, they definitely live longer in nature. And Happy's confined to like a 1 acre enclosure. And there, you know, some elephants in the wild roam, I don't know, up like up to 15, maybe 20 miles a day. There's wow. sanctuaries in the country that are, you know, like thousands of acres that we would be trying to seek Happy and our other clients for them to be released there because they obviously can't go back to their native environments.
Yeah, I think one of your experts made the analogy that it was like spending the entirety of your life in a very small home, right?
Yes.
In isolation. Yeah.
Yeah, in isolation without other members of your species. And elephants are social species. They need family. They need to be around other elephants. And so even just detaining an elephant away from, you know, a social clan is very harmful to the elephant.
Hmm. All right. So mock cross here. Where's the dividing line going to be, right? If elephants have, have the right of self-determination, and let me kind of fill in the punchline, I have a puppy at home, right? Mm-hmm. Like how are we not going to free all of the dogs in the state of New York by ruling that some non-human animals have the right to bodily autonomy that can be exercised on their behalf by somebody else?
Yeah, great question. So there's a lot of ways to answer this, but I'm going to start with just like a precedent-based one, which is that if we look historically at the cases in which our cases are sort of modeled off of, which are those the slave cases in which entities be human beings, but they were not considered legal persons, were able to use the common law writ of habeas corpus and essentially, you know, challenge their detention and their status as a non-person and then get freedom through the writ if they were able to prove it, and then thereby become persons for the limited purpose of being free. And so in those cases, when a court, say in like a northern state, would recognize the freedom of a southern slave by the writ of habeas corpus, it didn't emancipate all slaves. It would only apply to that one individual. So the remedy itself we're seeking, it's not legislation. It's not saying all elephants are free. It's Happy is free. And there's really only so many elephants. And it's based off of the autonomy of the species and all of, you know, we're saying that autonomy is basically a sufficient quality to have, but we're basing that off of all of this science, all of these expert reports. We don't know if dogs have, autonomy, but we don't know if that autonomy is being infringed upon when they are detained by human beings. We know that elephants suffer immensely when they're in captivity and that their autonomy is infringed upon. They're not able to exercise it freely. Dogs have been so domesticated to the point where it's a little bit different. The other legal argument is just, again, when you combine it with equality points too, an elephant in captivity is sort of similarly situated to, you know, a human child or another being that's in captivity, whereas a dog wouldn't be so similarly situated. So the equality arguments that we have in our brief sort of cabin the slippery slope argument too.
Well, let me ask though, what about the goals of your organization? I mean, is it truly just to free these particular animals, or is it part of a larger effort that maybe, you know, you're starting at one place and trying to get to another? I'm just curious. And by the way, I'm a vegetarian, so I would like more animals to have the personhood rights, but that's just me personally.
We support a lot of the animal welfare efforts of other organizations, and I think all of us personally are animal welfare folks as well as we are animal rights folks. But the purposes of our organization is to really kick down the door that divides this arbitrary and arcane division between non-human and human. The fact that all humans have all these rights, regardless of whether they're even aware, or, you know, self-aware at all. They could be a comatose human in a vegetative state, and the law recognizes them as having the whole panoply of rights. And a highly sentient, highly intelligent elephant that is aware of her environment, that cannot exercise, you know, that has so much more harm being done to her by this confinement than a similarly situated human in a vegetative state, that's a wrong. That's mm-hmm. just manifestly unjust. And that needs to be corrected kind of regardless of the future applications of this principle. So we're kind of focused on the most immediate and glaring injustices, which are those highly autonomous species, chimpanzees, cetaceans, and elephants. But what the future holds, I don't think in our lifetime, and it's certainly not a stated goal of ours to get farmed animals habeas corpus. We think there's probably more direct and effective ways to help save farmed animals that wouldn't be habeas corpus. But that's not a limiting thing. Like, it's kind of like just like any other common law expansion, there's always this resistance. You know, these arguments were made against black slavery and why we shouldn't emancipate slaves. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good enough reason to say, well, we're going to have to free other beings that are suffering. Well, if that's the case, then that'll eventually be the case. But the reality is right now we're facing a serious injustice and it needs to be corrected.
Yeah. You talk about self-aware. One of the things that struck me from a factual perspective that I didn't really know was that elephants pass the mirror test. You want to kind of talk a little bit about the significance of that? And I mean, that was news to me, right? When I think of, you know, I think of primates and I think of cetaceans as sort of being, you know, cognitively advanced. But this surprised me.
Yeah. So the mere self-recognition test is a way of determining whether an animal or species is self-aware. And so they use a mirror, and if the animal is able to identify themselves rather than like another elephant, and they can do that by like placing like chalk on like a shoulder, and if the elephant, you know, tries to, I don't know exactly, I forget the test that was used for Happy, but I think it was something with chalk. And if they're able to see themselves and try to remove it or, you know, act on it, then that's recognizing that it's themselves not another elephant.
Yeah, I don't even think I'm a person. I look in the mirror, I'm like, oh, who is that?
Oh, God. Yeah, I know, right?
This is an old person. What happened? Yeah.
I mean, human infants can't pass that test, right? Like, right. I don't know what point of development, but
yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, just sort of goes to the point you were making previously in terms of the argument for marginal cases.
Yeah. And that's also our ability to test, you know, their awareness. And I'm always, when I go back to say like chimpanzees and some of the great apes, I just like to remind people like they can communicate in our language. Like we've been able to teach, you know, chimpanzees and great apes like sign language. So they're basically speaking, you know, in some form of like English with us, and or, you know, or at least in human, and we can't speak. I know Jane Goodall, I think, we had a really fun event with the LA City Council back in, I think it was 2019, and Jane Goodall taught the members of the City Council some chimpanzee language for Jane Goodall Day that we had there. And it was just really fun to hear her kind of like hooting in the halls of LA County City Council.
Because we will get the emails. I do want to flag that there's an excellent episode of You're Wrong About that it does throw a little bit of cold water on the teaching chimpanzees sign language stuff. Like,
yeah.
It might be more akin to like, allegedly more akin to teaching a dog a kind of a trick and associating it with food. So there's a little bit of controversy there, but the point still stands that animals do have amazing abilities that it's hard for us to recognize often.
Yes. And I think once you read, I'm kind of using a very base, this would be like maybe the elevator speech, and mm-hmm. I'm not a primatologist, but we have experts that have detailed like all of these kind of examples where we know, you know, the chimpanzees, mm-hmm. like they'll plan for the visitors coming to a zoo and they'll like stash up like piles of poo and like throw them at the visitors because they're like angry that they have to be there. You know, like they do things that are like intentional, and like intention and future planning are decidedly, you know, high order intelligence. Like, tomorrow the visitors are coming. There's a segment in our documentary, Unlocking the Cage, where my boss, Steve, is going to see this, I think it was a bonobo. And the bonobo was using, it was one of those computers that sort of translates, but it was visitor has ball. And Steve was holding, my boss was holding like an orange or an apple, like a piece of fruit. And it was like, I want the ball that the visitor has. Like, to recognize that my boss was a visitor and not like, you know, I don't know. Just it's very interesting when you look at the science. And I think there probably are parts of science that you can critique, like those tests. But there's other tests out there that are not mainstream that
absolutely
I think are worth looking at.
Yeah. The stockpiling poo, I think, is a really good argument about future planning.
Yeah.
I want to keep continuing sort of to intertwine, because I think this is both a legal and a philosophical question.
Sure it is.
Obviously, some of the law stuff kind of came up more for me. There's a citation in your brief where you are discussing that domestic and pet animals have trust beneficiary rights under New York law. Can you like kind of explain that argument to me and sort of pull out the implications?
Yes. Yes. I'd love to, especially because I deep dived and did a lot of this pet trust research back when I was in law school. Yeah. So this was one of those arguments that really kind of evolved. And some judges, I think Judge Jaffe, our first judge, actually really took to it and was like, yeah, New York law kind of already does recognize a limited personhood. And frankly, you know, when I saw the Hippo press release come out, my first thought was, if we're going to say anything has our, you know, the first sort of rights recognized for animals in this country, I would argue, if anything, they're the pet trusts. Because the pet trusts, in some states, not others, most states have some version of an ability to allow you to leave something for your pet if you die. But they don't all recognize those as like enforceable trusts. Some of them are considered honorary. But several states, like New York, decided to be really explicit in saying that in enacting their statute that allows for pets to be taken care of after the death of the owner, that the animal is the beneficiary and it's not an honorary trust. It is an animal as a beneficiary. You want to get into the rule of perpetuities. They're using the animal as the life in being. And I know, and it's funny because I saw a meme about rule against perpetuities and how these bar student people that passed the bar recently are like, I still don't understand the rule against perpetuities. But the bottom line is that the law in New York and several other states is very explicit that an animal can be the beneficiary and only legal persons can be beneficiaries of a trust and be entitled to the claims of the money under the trust and have an enforcer and a guardian and other statutory accoutrements.
We're doing like an impromptu Are You a Cop segment right here on the show, because this is the kind of thing that I would have thought, eventually I would have had to have researched and exploded as a myth. But you're saying that like the sitcom idea of I can, in my will, like leave my house to my dog, that New York law and other states recognize that as a valid conveyance to a legal interest?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a trust expert.
I disagree with that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, and there was actually a big case about a million. So some of these pet trusts have been mocked for that reason, because there's been like $1 million grants to
Didn't Marge Schott try and leave like the Cincinnati Reds to her dog?
There's some cases that were pretty outlandish and they might have been overturned just on like was the donor cognizant of what they were doing? But those were big legal battles, but there's plenty of legitimate reasons for these statutes, practical reasons. A lot of old people do have cats and dogs, and who takes care of them and how do we make sure they're taken care of? And so creating a little fund and designating a caretaker has a practical reason. And then some legislators went further to make it really just clear that the animals are the beneficiaries. And if you look at, for instance, Connecticut and New York too, the legislative history of their statutes and the amendments that were added to them to make the animal the life in being and to make sure they're actually enforceable and not honorary, they are recognizing that animals, as pets, are specifically like parts of people's families. And a lot of people consider their dogs like children. And if you accept our argument that those create a limited form of personhood, then it's really not a leap at all to say that elephants should have a limited right to not be in captivity if Fluffy the dog is able to receive, you know, $1 million inheritance. Just sort of joking there. But really, it's there's already efforts made to recognize the personhood in animals, even pets.
This show is brought to you by Raycon. Folks, you know what time of the year it is. It's almost holiday time, and it's never too early to start gift shopping for the holidays, especially because those supply chain issues. So you got to get on it right now. And if you want a great idea for a gift that you can save big on and that someone you love will use every day, it's Raycon wireless earbuds. I use my Raycons all the time because I'm the kind of person who I can't just be doing one thing. I'm either, if I'm doing chores, if I'm outside, if I'm doing whatever, I have to be listening to stuff because I love listening to podcasts. I love listening to books. And so I use my Raycons whenever I'm doing chores, whenever I'm doing something that I could be taking advantage of that time to listen, I do. With seamless Bluetooth pairing and a comfortable noise isolating fit, you can start listening right away and keep listening for hours. The audio quality is amazing, comparable to what you get from other premium brands, except Raycon starts at half the price. The new everyday earbuds come with three new sound profiles just to make sure everything you're listening to sounds its best with just the right amount of bass. There's pure mode, there's balanced mode, and there's bass mode. So you might change if you're listening to podcasts versus music, and it's got those different modes that you can check out. And here's the most important thing. Raycon, to me anyway, offers 8 hours of playtime and a 32-hour battery life. That's a ton. Because there's nothing worse than when you are set to do something, a long chore, a long walk, or whatever, jog, and you're like, all right, got my earbuds, and they're out of battery, and you can't enjoy any of that stuff in that time you had. But the Raycons have that long battery life, so that won't happen as often. There's also a built-in mic, and you can take calls on your earbuds at the press of a button. So this holiday season, get them something they can use for calls, for music, for work or play, at home or on the go, or pick up a pair for yourself. Trust me, you're going to use them every day. So go to buyraycon.com/opening today to unlock exclusive deals up to 20% off your Raycon order. But hurry, this offer is available for a limited time only, and you don't want to miss it. That's buyraycon.com/opening to unlock 20% off your Raycons. Buyraycon, RAYCON.com/opening. Yeah, I just think some of the contradictions in this are so interesting, too. You know, I know this is probably not exactly along the same legal lines, but examples like if you saw someone beating a dog or something, you could call the police on them. But yet, you know, we have factory farming that abuses animals to ridiculous extents. And by the way, like, talk about cognitive abilities. There's a lot of people who think like pigs are at about the same level as dogs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so it's really sad. Like, regardless, I know a lot of people just write this stuff off as like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of vegetarian vegan hate out there. But
yeah,
I don't know. I think it's a lot of those same people who are happy to eat meat and don't care about what goes on factory farming. I think they really would be viscerally affected if it was dogs that were in that same situation. And there's no reason to think that something like a pig, you know, isn't somewhere near that level. And it's just kind of horrifying. So I know I already asked like the long-term goals. I mean, you said before that it's not about creating legislation. It is a kind of a one-off thing and as the comparison to what happened during slavery of granting limited rights of personhood. But is it the kind of thing where a victory could then be cited in any number of other cases and effectively become, like, if not a law, at least a precedent?
Yeah. And I mean, of course, that's what we want. And we're seeing that already in a very positive way. We've already had a huge impact internationally. There are several cases in which courts abroad have cited our litigation efforts in the U.S. to grant a bear, an orangutan, and some other entities rights in like Colombia and Brazil, Argentina. So yes, we want that. I think the Oregon Supreme Court cited our litigation and said something about how maybe today we're not at that point where we're recognizing animals as more than mere things, but we're on the cusp of doing so, citing our New York cases. And the fact that the New York Court of Appeals has taken it, I mean, certainly the precedent will build. Our goal, like I said, is immediate, that we want the freedom of these animals. We want the recognition of the right to bodily liberty for animals that deserve it. But what happens from there on out is up to the justice system and how the common law sort of builds and develops.
Yeah. And I think you are 100% correct that the fact that the highest court in New York recognizes that this is a non-trivial question, right, is itself kind of a move forward. I wanted to drill down a little bit. You mentioned Colombia. Well, obviously, you know, that was the subject of the Pablo Escobar escaped hippos. Something I was really unable to figure out from just parsing through the affidavits in that case, were the representations being made by the attorney, by the Colombian attorney, that Colombian law recognized non-human animals as persons? And yeah, we actually, you know, you probably recall listening to the episode, Thomas and I went down a little bit of a rabbit trail of like, mm-hmm. you know, how deep does that get, right? Like what, yeah. to what extent is that recognition and how deep does that yeah. go? What can you tell us about that?
Well, we had a similar reaction. So we were asked, my boss was actually invited. So the case that we're referring to is the Chucho the bear case. Mm-hmm. But that I think was the impetus for the hippo case's claims. And I might be saying Chucho wrong, but Chaco, I think maybe is how you say Chaco. Now that I'm saying Chaco, I'm like, yeah, that's the name. And so my boss was actually invited to give some insight to the Columbia highest court as to whether... Oh, that wow. bear would be entitled to habeas corpus. Yeah, it was a little, I can't remember all of the ins and outs of it, but the bottom line is it had to do with a bear having habeas corpus. And I think actually the case ended up not going in favor of the bear, but yielding some good opinion or some good dicta from maybe the dissent. But the bottom line is when we saw the hippo case's claims, we were also confused because we don't really know what the Colombia law means. We know a little bit, but international law is international law. And, you know, India, for instance, has granted a lot of personhood rights to entities other than, India has been at the forefront of some of these really interesting rulings that we're looking at. But we spent a lot of time reading, interpreting, talking to translators, talking to specialists in those areas, because the Indian constitution says that certain animals have personhood now. Well, India doesn't enforce even like human rights really well. So just because they are declaring it doesn't make it happen. And so we don't know. I'm certainly no expert in Colombian law, and I don't want to purport to misspeak. But we, you know, all we know is that there was a bear case. And I think that Colombian law probably does recognize the hippos as persons. But I'm still having a hard time figuring out how that relates to the federal law in question.
That's fair. I asked you an impossibly hard question that, you know, that I punted on that, you know, where we've got a language barrier in between. But Are you doing the oral argument in this case or?
No. So Steve is going to be doing that. And I think the oral argument's slated for, well, we don't have a date yet, but we think it's going to be in the new year, sometime in 2022.
Yeah. If I recall correctly, the court sort of opened up for, you know, a number of amicus briefs, which, as you can imagine, lots of folks are interested in in this case.
Yeah, well, I do want to mention we've had Lawrence Tribe support for a long time, and he filed an amicus brief that got some attention from the reporters. We've also had some famous philosophers file amicus briefs for us. We've had theologians. We had a Catholic theologian brief filed on our behalf. You know, now our cases are being featured in like National Geographic and Time Magazine. So it's definitely being taken, our claims are being taken very seriously by very serious scholars, whether you agree with Tribe on other issues or not. I think the fact that someone as serious as Lawrence Tribe has been on the side of the Non-Human Rights Project for as long as he has and enough to write amicus briefs in the New York State of, New York Court of Appeals, I think it's really speaks some volume to what how serious our case is versus some of these other ones.
Yeah.
I play the part of the non-lawyer on the show and I do it really, really well. I'm really good at not being a lawyer. We've talked about a bunch of cases. I know you two know exactly what's going on in everything. So, but can for non-lawyers like me following along, what's the actual status of Happy the Elephant? What's going on? Is there more to happen? I kind of lost the thread on that a little bit.
Yeah. So basically what happened is once the court, I think it was in May, May of this year, granted our appeal, then we filed a brief. They filed a brief. We filed our reply brief, and then the court did open it up for amicus briefs. So those have been coming in. And so now we're just waiting on an oral argument date.
Okay. So when Andrew was talking about a loss, that was at some lower level? And is this an appeal or something?
Oh, yes, correct. So that's right. At the beginning, we did lose, and we appealed to the first department, which is New York's intermediate court, and then we lost that appeal, so then we took it up to the highest court. But the loss that we had in the district, in the lowest court in New York, was basically as close to a win as you can get for a loss. It was like the Non-Human Rights Project, you know, should win. You know, elephants are autonomous, and basically echoing the points in our brief, but then noting that there was a New York intermediate appellate decision that we had generated from one of our earlier, the chimpanzee case, in which there was this really bad dicta about it's, and this is one of the reasons maybe the Court of Appeals took the case, but it basically had said that in order to have rights, you need to have the ability to shoulder duties and responsibilities, which doesn't make sense because there's plenty of rights bearers in New York that do not and are incapable of bearing rights, duties yeah. and responsibilities, children, mentally incapacitated adults, etc. So what New York, this intermediate Trump court voters. Had, no. yeah, exactly. This intermediate court had basically said something that was so blatantly wrong, and we couldn't get it corrected that time around. We did appeal it, and they didn't take our case. And we finally, on one of our appeals, we got a really good dissent. Judge Fahey of the New York Court of Appeals, and he basically had also said this is worth hearing the next time it comes to us.
Well, that's great. So let me ask you a question that I assiduously did not ask when you were on to talk about the Bladensburg Cross case, because all of us in that area sort of have to come on and put on, you know, the best spin for a Supreme Court that's been unremittingly hostile to the notion of separation of church and state. This seems like it's a depoliticized territory, I think, and B, you know, it's the New York's highest court. So, you know, we don't need to talk about, you know, what Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh think about it. How do you rate your chances? What do you think's going to happen?
Yeah, it's interesting. It is nice and refreshing to not be having to wonder what Amy and Brett are going to be doing. I don't know. And honestly, being in this area and then also being in the church state separation area, which feels more predictable in a way, like you get a Trump judge, very unlikely to win. Like, but here it's not political. We've had rural New York judges that maybe even hunt, but also love like chimpanzees. One of our first judges was conservative. We figured that out from his voting or something, but he loved chimpanzees. And when the lawyers that were filing the original case walked into the office, we have this on the documentary, it was like he had like all these like tchotchkes that were like chimpanzee specific. We're like, well, this is good. This is promising. Yeah. And so, you know, I cannot tell you. Everyone has, on both sides of the political aisle, have different views on personhood and animals. And it's not enough to know what their political background is, you know, if they're Democrat. Mm-hmm. It's not even enough to know if they love dogs and cats. A lot of people love pets and don't care about personhood for other animals or personhood at all. So, yeah.
I feel like there's got to be a little bit of correlation, you know, like
the
asshole Trump sons are the ones posing with the pictures of hunting probably some of these very same animals.
Yeah, you can make some assumptions, but we were in the first department, which is considered, we thought it was going to be the most progressive court in New York because it was the one based in Manhattan. And we were pretty shocked at how rudimentary some of their questions were about this, whereas we had more advanced and serious conversations with judges that were not as advanced career-wise. So I feel
the only area where you're like, yes, we got a kangaroo court, awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Fantastic. Yeah,
that's my one dad joke for the
it's true though. And yeah, I'm optimistic. I mean, it would be a big humongous victory, and we're asking for a leap here, but I don't think the court would take the case if it wasn't prepared to at least consider it potentially ruling in our favor, or else they would just affirm.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Like just thinking about the other side, right? The Bronx Zoo side. Whenever you've won and the Supreme Court, the next appellate court, a cert court decides this is a case worth hearing, you're like, oh, Well, you probably didn't do that to pat us on the back and congratulate us on what a fantastic decision.
Exactly.
I have to ask you, because we got this question a dozen times via email after expressing some sympathy for non-human personhood on episode 538. So I'll ask it of you. Would you have concerns that establishing personhood for non-human animals would create the kind of legal precedent and record that could then be turned around and used to try and establish personhood for fetuses and, you know, really crack down on reproductive and women's rights?
You know, no. I think those are already on their own path right now, unfortunately, like regardless of what we want. But I don't think that there's a correlation. I think partially because the science, if you just look at the science of a human, I mean, that makes our argument so much more compelling. If you want to compare a human clump of cells, like I don't even really say human, a clump of cells with an elephant, with a chimpanzee, where we've got science showing that they're self-aware, that they're planning for the next day, that they're aware of their future, they're aware of their past, they can make gestures and communicate with one another versus a clump of cells. So our arguments with autonomy really do turn a lot on science, and at least ask the court to consider the science, because it makes the injustice that much more apparent.
I totally agree. I was going to say the same thing. I think if anything, it cuts the other way.
Yeah.
I mean, so many of these cases, it's like, look at what this animal can do that this idiot baby can't do. I say that as a father of two beautiful children.
Yeah,
but when they're infants, there's nothing there.
Yeah,
they're not really even people for months, in my opinion.
Exactly. I mean,
and by a certain definition, if you're trying to look at some of these criteria.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and obviously I'm setting up a devil's advocacy argument there. I would add that the relief that you're seeking here, right, in terms of habeas corpus relief, like I would be happy to replicate that over for, you know, for fetuses, right? Like the right to be extracted and let alone.
That's a very good point too, because that in turn, by recognizing the personhood of the fetus, will bring on a lot of questions about the welfare of that. It's just so bizarre to me. The clump of cells.
You know, I gotta say, while we're spitballing strategy here, have you considered trying to have someone pass a law that elephants can't carry guns? And then use that to get conservative. No, they can. They can carry guns.
Yeah.
They're a Second Amendment person.
There's days where I sometimes think about weird stuff like that. I'm like, it might be easier to get like an elephant's right to carry arms. In fact, we were working with another country, and it was an African country, about getting passports for some chimpanzees that would recognize their personhood. And there's some sort of like, sometimes there's like practical things where like, being recognized as an individual that has inherent worth and dignity, like, kind of makes sense. But yes, 100%, I think in Florida, it would be easier to get an elephant the right to bear arms than the right to freedom, unfortunately.
Well, that's... I guess we can't have any segment that doesn't end with sort of the institutional corruption of our courts in America by right-wing ideologues.
Yeah.
Monica, anything else that you really want to add about the case that we haven't covered that folks should know about?
I think I've covered everything. I mean, I would reiterate again that, you know, it's not a welfare case. It's a rights case, and that we are the only organization solely dedicated to seeking actual animal rights versus welfare.
That's great. Well, that is the Non-Human Rights Project. They're at nonhumanrights.org. Anything you want to plug if someone wants to support, help out?
No, but I mean, obviously support and donations are extremely welcome. They really help our litigation immensely. If folks are able to give, there's information on our website.
Monica Miller, thanks so much for coming back. Hopefully we don't wait as long to have you back next time. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah. It was so fun to be on the show again.
Thank you.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats. Our top patrons on patreon.com/law. We've got a great Lot Awful Movies coming at you pretty soon. So it's a good time to sign on to patreon.com/law. Enjoy ad-free episodes each and every episode. Get your Sunday episode early. So this one you're listening to, you would have gotten this Sunday night instead of Tuesday. I mean, come on. What a value. And of course, we've switched to the... I'm not going to say it. This is a quartile.
This is a quartile system.
We're on fourths in November. I looked ahead, and that's what we're on. And Andrew, why don't you start us off with our first fourth of Hall of Famers?
All right. Thank you, too. Star Trek is better than Star Wars. That's 100% true. A Streetcar Named D's Nuts. that's so funny. Hail Nimrod. The Nimrod story. I want to do. Ask me a question about Nimrod in the next Q&A because I want to do my little riff on that. Anyway, Vortex's plural is riveting story like Andrew and Thomas, but more of a butt clencher in suspense. I forgot to change my Patreon name after it got read the first time, and I'm still deciding on a new one. Andrew Klausenbucher. Klotzenbucher. LT, salty Seattle driver on YouTube, debunks the stupid idea that hazard lights mean you can park literally wherever you want. I graduated the U.S. Army SEER, pronounced like the word seer, that's S-E-R-E, school, and all I got was this lousy username. Well, and congratulations, you got that too. She says she shall sew a sheet. Wow. Pessaries on jet skis, the musical. Matt Dunlap, I move 7,000 miles away and all I want is Mexican food. I could go for some Mexican food. Sydney, this writ of cert is written on a cocktail napkin and amicus is spelt wrong and it still says you're getting disbarred. Love it. Joseph Vigiano, Dr. Scoop Little, welcome aboard, Dr. Scoop Little. Doug and Heather, Mr. and Mrs. Pusher. Well, congratulations, Doug and Heather. Comedian Aaron Trahan, at Comedian AET, come to Madhouse Comedy Club in San Diego. Ooh. Now here's something we hope you'll really like. I'm only a teaching associate, but textbook publishers insist on calling me Doctor and Professor. Donna's Tropic Skincare for UK patrons only. Do you have any of these? Do you have any of those except me? Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we have plenty. We have plenty UK patrons.
Yeah.
Lots of them.
Hand-woven, night-safe, reflective scarves by kellywovet.com. Oh, that sounds awesome. For a fun fantasy story, read The King's Own by W. Marshall, now on Amazon. Take it away, Thomas.
That thing in the attic. The fat Jedi eating cake and drinking Emperor's Brewery beer in the Death Star canteen. Liberals owning guns, too. Support root cause mitigation, not ineffective gun control. Good news, everyone. Good news, everyone. I've invented a way to make you read this in my voice. Oh, I didn't do the rest of it, but I should have. Sorry. Sean McGovern, John Spartan, you are fined 1 credit for a violation of the verbal moralities. Support Decarcerate, working to end mass incarceration in Arkansas. DecarcerateAR.org. Tell Morgan Gatam's son, Ray, Pizza School the Corgi, the cutest corgi in this OA quintile, or your money back. Nice. LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Legal Eagle is so handsome. California employment, work, accident, or litigation questions. Call or text attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, 310-776-5879. John Strange, The Smiths. Do take DNS advice from our live streams. Praise be unto Hamilton. Please don't elect an O'Toole. Living in constant dread of the current SCOTUS term. 3 appointees by an imbecile were enough. Yeah. Horse 2 is Stormer, a sweet and kind Icelandic gelding who's convinced everything is trying to eat him. He does his best. Budget botanist on Fiverr. There are 400,000 species of plants, but only one. Opening arguments. Please offer any suggestions for podcasts that would read my Patreon name weekly, asking for a friend. Oh, thank you so much. I love it. We're reading all your names. It just takes a month instead of a week. It's better for the show. We got to squeeze in more Monica Miller because of this shortened segment. Now, I dare you to contradict me. That's a good choice. That's a good trade-off. But we love still being able to read everybody.
Sometimes you eat the bar, and sometimes the bar while he eats you.
And now it's time for T3B answer time. This feels straightforward, but I bet it's not. Let's see if I got it wrong.
This was a defendant on trial for robbery, had recently robbed a department store. The co-conspirator went to the cops, broke down, said, "I can't take it anymore. The defendant and I committed the robbery." The defendant was then arrested. The co-conspirator has not said a word, says he's not going to testify. He's not going to show up at any hearing or trial. The prosecutor then wants to put the lead investigator, the person to whom the co-conspirator confessed, on the stand regarding the statement made by the co-conspirator. Defendant moves to suppress the statement. Will it likely be admitted? And before we get into the answers, this is one of these where I want to confess to the audience. Sometimes when I'm playing along I'll get these wrong, right? Because the bar exam is hard. Mm-hmm. This is one I got wrong. Ooh. And I'm going to tell you, I got it wrong.
I have a hard time imagining I got this right if you got it wrong. So it's probably going to be, I wonder if Second Chance even got it, if survived. We'll see.
As it turns out. So you narrowed it down to either A or D. A, yes, as a statement by a co-conspirator. Or D, no, because the statement is hearsay and does not fall under any exception. And I have to tell you, not only are neither of those the correct answer, the dilemma, neither are the correct answer or my answer, right? So
okay. Well, we covered it all.
We covered the landscape. I went with B incorrectly. Yes, as a statement against interest.
Wow.
This is a statement against interest. This is 100% a valid hearsay exception statement against interest. The declarant is unavailable. He refuses to testify, and he's confessed to a crime. So that's okay. What I applied. But I very stupidly ignored C. And again, we've talked about this sometimes, how the bar will use, you know, that kind of fluffy language. No, because it would violate the defendant's constitutional rights. Well, what the hell does that mean? Well, we were just talking about the Confrontation Clause. Yeah. That's exactly the constitutional rights that come into play. So, right, statement against interest, hearsay, that is from the federal rules and from common law. And so it is. So it would be in, but for the fact that the Constitution sits on top of that and says, no, you have a right to face your accuser if the co-conspirator is saying, yeah, you committed this crime, we're not going to bring in his statement without bringing him in. So,
this is okay. For a second, I was very confused because, this is hilarious. Like, we did talk about this exact thing, but we talked about it as the underlying basis for the logic of hearsay, you know, and so like, it made sense to be like, yeah, okay, it's still hearsay though, even though, yeah, it's the constitutional right to confront your accuser. Now, then I just thought of, is this the key distinction? If this had been about some issue that wasn't the entirety of the accusation, then would B be the correct answer?
That is exactly right.
But because this is like, you are the accuser and this is the thing that like is the whole basis for you being accused, you need to be able to confront that person directly.
That is exactly right. And the Sixth Amendment test that is based on is the testimonial nature test. And that's exactly what it is. Is the purpose of the statement to establish or prove past events potentially relevant to the criminal prosecution? If it is, you got to be able to cross-examine that person.
Well, then I feel like I was closer than you. I had a no answer.
I think that's right. Let me also briefly talk about the yes as a statement by co-conspirator. Statements by co-conspirators are admissible under the hearsay rules if they are about stuff that took place during the conspiracy.
Okay.
But here, the conspiracy was completed, done, and then, you know, a week later, he went and confessed. That is kind of textbook, not statement by a co-conspirator.
So during the crime.
Right.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. And then I keep getting confused about statement against interest. I thought that had to be the actual defendant saying something against their interest. Why would that have worked in this case?
Because remember, so we've talked about the history of hearsay, right? And the idea is hearsay is inherently suspicious, unreliable, because you don't have the person who said it testifying, right? You have somebody else saying that they said it. And so, you know, we're skeptical of that. But then the idea is that there's some things that people say that have such a high level of reliability that we don't need to cross-examine them. Now, some of this seems bizarre to me, right? Like the dying declarations, right?
And also, the thing that got me on this particular case, and I'm not trying to crap on your answer, I promise, was this seems like it was a statement in the interest of the co-conspirator. I mean, well, no, the co-conspirator is coming and saying, I need to unburden myself. You know, like when you think about what makes hearsay more reliable, you would think it was more reliable if someone's like, oh crap, I accidentally admitted something against my interest but didn't mean to, whereas this is a person being like, hello, I'm coming in my own self-interest, at least under my own power, like I voluntarily am coming in and telling you a thing, because for all we know, hypothetically, this guy couldn't even, he could be not a co-conspirator. It could be like, oh, that's my neighbor that I hate. I'm going to say that we did it. You know what I mean? So like it felt against interest in that way.
Well, and look, you can, I mean, that's why I just used the dying declaration, right? Like you can concoct ways to abuse the hearsay rules because, again, these are left over from 13th century Saxony. I'm definitely going to utter a dying declaration, against
Matt Gaetz and I stole some money in the 80s, right, 90s.
Yeah. I was going to say the kid that used to beat me up when I was in elementary school, but maybe Matt Gaetz will take priority over that. But no, notwithstanding the potential for abuse, the idea is that people make up self-serving things, but something that's like really, really bad. You know, if I call you up and I'm like, Thomas, man, I got to tell you, I just killed this dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what makes it, I guess, okay, if we ignore everything else, if you're a judge trying to decide a narrow question of like, here's a statement and it's either hearsay or not, based on this one question of against interest or not, what is the criteria you're exactly using to make that judgment as a judge?
Yeah, and there are, and the answer is there's no one criterion, right? Like there's a body of case law. Yeah,
it's a multi-point list invented by Sandra Day O'Connor, you're going to tell me?
I might be. But I would say confessing to a crime has always been, since time immemorial, considered a classic statement against interest.
Fair enough. So if this was somebody that just came in and was like, yeah, I saw him, it was this guy. Then different story. Now, again, that's the accuser. So you do need to be able to confront your accuser.
Exactly.
But setting that aside, then it would no longer be against interest. And how would that work? So if a witness comes in, I'm clarifying, this is always, I'm trying to glean a little extra info for next time. That's what I'm always trying to do. Replace the question with a witness came in and said the following thing. Again, setting aside answer C, we'll just pretend to ignore that. Is it no longer admissible? So if a witness comes in and tells the police, I saw this person do it, but then doesn't want to testify anywhere, does that like the mafia-esque intimidate the witness out of testifying and then you get off?
Off the top of my head, and again, you can see how many trials I do, I think that does not, I'm struggling to come up with what hearsay exception that would be. If it's just an incidental witness who refuses to testify and you have their prior statement, yeah, I'd want to go back through the list of like unavailable declarant in the rules. And I'm sure I could concoct an argument for it. But off the top of my head, I can't come up with a quick one. So I know there's going to be some obvious one, but
that's fine.
We're doing this live.
I failed miserably. Didn't even get second chance. That's rough. Whoopsie daisy there. I would have had to go with C and D, though, I think, in order to, that would be rough. So that was a tough one. But Andrew got it wrong also. So you know what? There's still hope for me. There's still hope for me yet. This will be an interesting one to check with time traveling Andrew and see who got this one right. I'm curious who our big winner is.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Roger Allen Ford on Twitter, who writes, pretty sure it's C, violation of the Confrontation Clause. Thomas's intuition about why you can't use the testimony is right on, but that's a constitutional problem, not a hearsay problem. And if I'm wrong, well, not my fault. I never took evidence. Well, you know, neither did you. But that's the correct answer on C for the correct reasons. So congratulations, Roger, on being this week's winner. And everyone, let's give them a follow. They are at R Ford on Twitter, at R-F-O-R-D. And once again, congratulations on being this week's winner.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks again to Monica Miller for joining us. Really interesting stuff there. Can't wait to follow along with that as well. And maybe, we'll get her back on sometime. Thanks always, Andrew, for the breakdowns. And we'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.